Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Featured Voices podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is August 6, 2019. Economics is said to be a dismal science. I don't think it's a science at all, but often, mostly, a loose means of providing cover for politicians and corporations to justify and rationalize, maybe even acting in self-interested ways. What we're going to be covering today is a fascinating story of how economists even came to be as prominent as they are. You know, once upon a time, there was no role at all for an economist. And today, they are prominently perched in every major bank, in central banks, corporations, and governments. Today's guest is Binyamin Applebaum, who joined the New York Times editorial board in 2019. From 2010 to 2019, he was a Washington correspondent for the Times covering the Federal Reserve and other aspects of economic policy. He is the recipient of a Polk Award and a Loeb Award, and he has also been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Public Service. His first book, hot off the presses, is The Economist Hour, which traces the rise of the economists first in the United States and then around the globe as their ideas reshaped the modern world, curbing government, unleashing corporations, and hastening globalization. I got my hands on an advanced copy and immediately got immersed in it, read it straight through. If you want to know where you're going, you have to know where you are. And to know that, you have to know where you came from. The Economist Hour does a spectacularly good job of tracing the many paths that got us here to this moment in time. Binyamin, welcome to the program.
It's really great to be with you.
So, Binyamin, tell us, how was it that you came to write a book about economists? Was that a lifelong dream?
I wouldn't say it was a lifelong dream, but as you said in the intro, I've been writing about economic policy actually for about 15 years now, at the Times for about 10 years. And, you know, in the course of writing about today's policies, in the course of writing about what is happening now, I became interested in how we had gotten to this point, and in particular, really fascinated by what I started to learn about how recent our current approach to policymaking is, how recently economists, who we now think of as kind of permanent fixtures in the halls of power, how recently they had come to be there, and how recently their approach to policymaking had taken hold. And that was fascinating to me because it's a revolution that I think was, you know, so complete that for many people, the idea that there was something before it is kind of lost in the mists of time. And I wanted to go back and first learn that story myself, and then second, share it with readers, because exactly as you said, I think that it really is a powerful thing to understand how we came to be where we are.
Well, it truly is. And what I love about your book is that when you take on an issue like, for example, what happened to antitrust laws and activity, you rewind that tape far enough back that we can understand how we got here. Like in every case, we didn't just land here. This isn't like the best way to do things. There's a creeping and crawling as laws, customs, social mores were bent, maybe bent some more. So if we look at just this one aspect, it seems to me that antitrust, this is how it seems to me today, personal observation, it's so dead that, say, insulin manufacturers can lockstep hike their prices far into socially damaging territory. People are dying, right? And yet there's not a peep from the U.S. Department of Justice about that or 100 other cases I could probably announce. But within the confines of the interview, just in that one example, let's talk about how did we get to this position of antitrust being a really well-practiced device a long time ago to today where it's almost unheard of?
I think that this is one of the most fascinating examples of the ways that economists have transformed public policy. So I'm glad you decided to start there. Antitrust laws in this country, we think of them as basically economic regulations today, but they were not written by economists. They were written in the late 19th century by people who were extremely concerned about the rise of corporate power and not even so much its impact on the marketplace, although they were worried about that, but also its impact on democracy. They feared that large corporations were threatening the very fabric of American life, that they would overwhelm democracy by becoming too powerful, that they would overwhelm small businesses by becoming too powerful, and that the United States had a vested interest in preventing corporate consolidation and the rise of these corporate titans. And so they wrote a law that was intended to prevent that type of corporate consolidation. And this is a really key point, even if it came at the expense of economic efficiency. I suspect during the course of the conversation today, we'll come back to this point a couple times, but you know, they understood that there was this tension between squeezing every last drop of growth out of the economy and other things which might also be important. And if you just prioritized economic efficiency, that might come at the expense of other things you considered valuable. For example, the survival of local small businesses, or the ability of a nation to make choices democratically, with the involvement of the entire population and not just to be dictated to by the interests of large corporations. So that was the way the law was written, and the most famous early example of its taking effect is the breakup of the Standard Oil Company in the early 20th century, as an example, perhaps the example of a corporation that was simply too large for the public good. And so that law for about, you know, well into the middle of the 20th century was understood to be aimed at a broad set of goals, and not to be primarily about maximizing economic output. And what we see is that in the mid-20th century, economists begin to gain a foothold in antitrust enforcement. And initially, they're invited into the room not so much because they disagree with the goals, but because they offer themselves as being able better to administer the policy. They basically say, listen, there's a lot of inconsistency from case to case. The mergers that the Justice Department is seeking to block, it lacks rhyme or reason, and we need to be more consistent. And that, you know, in and of itself seems reasonable enough. And so economists began to administer the laws and to argue that they should be, that cases should be evaluated on some economic basis. And gradually, and just as you say, it is a slow drift. It's not, you know, one stroke of the pen. It's not a single moment. But the idea that economists begin to advance is the idea that the sole standard for antitrust enforcement should be the impact on consumer prices. And furthermore, that companies should get the benefit of the doubt. And so where you end up, to jump ahead for a second, is in a world in which the only kinds of corporate activity that are thought to be out of bounds anymore are instances in which you can clearly demonstrate that the corporate conduct will lead to higher prices. And that, to be sure, is something we want to avoid, but it's not nearly broad enough. And the effect of that standard has been to disembowel antitrust enforcement, to take away any broader sense of its purpose, and to allow corporations to consolidate, sometimes simply because you can't prove in advance that prices are going to rise, and sometimes because prices actually don't rise, but lots of other bad things happen. One of the most important of which we're seeing more and more clearly, is that when you get corporate consolidation, workers have fewer choices about where to work. So if you have a particular skill set, and once there might have been two or three or four employers in your area who would value those skills, once corporate consolidation has taken hold, there may just be one. There may only be one place to work, and you will lose your leverage and your ability to negotiate for a better salary or benefits or what have you. We've seen innovation decline because companies that don't fear competition have less reason to invest in innovation. And we've seen exactly what was predicted now almost 150 years ago, which is that corporations now exert tremendous power over the political process. So economists, by basically saying, listen, we need to be able to measure outcomes, and so we should focus on something we can measure, we're able essentially to take control of the antitrust process. There's a wonderful story I tell in my book about a team of researchers wandering into the Justice Department in the early 1970s. And Justice at that time employed a few economists in the antitrust division, but they were basically human calculators. And in fact, one of them who was interviewed by this team interrupted the interview in mid-course to say, I'm sorry, I need to go, my master called. And what he meant is that the lawyer he worked for had told him to come do something. Today, that situation is almost entirely inverted. The lawyer's hands are tied. They cannot move forward with a case, essentially without the consent of the economists. And the economists in that position of authority have withheld their consent from almost all antitrust enforcement.
Well, and what I love is that what you've done in here is, in your book is talk about the many ways that there are these fixations that come about. So in this example, we're talking about antitrust has now come down to this fixation on the idea that, well, if it's about prices, that's the only good outcome that, that we're going to measure here. And in the case of insulin, which I just talked about, if you look at the price charts of insulin from different manufacturers, you can't see one from the other. They're such in perfect lockstep, and it's an exponential rise. So even in the case where we now have clear example of where the fixation, which was prices, we can still see that prices alone are not sufficient any longer to trigger any sort of an action or a reaction. You had another case in the book talking about how Eric Holder had really come forward with a very unusual sort of an idea or ruling around why we couldn't go after certain banks in particular. It was because it might have caused some disruption. He was worried about the market impacts, not the optics or the actual long-term consequences of his actions in terms of how that would erode confidence potentially or create various perverse incentives, if not moral hazards. So is that an appropriate way to connect those dots to say that there was this creeping to this point where now essentially no action can be taken because it might harm a company?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's an important, so the case of insulin actually illustrates this. It, almost as important as the exact definition of the antitrust standard is this incredibly important shift that really grew out of a set of economic thinkers at the University of Chicago who inverted. Traditionally, antitrust had held that corporations were inherently suspect of engaging in anti-competitive behavior. This is sort of an articulation of something that goes back to Adam Smith, who famously said that, you know, if there's a group of businessmen in a room, you can be pretty sure that they're plotting against their consumers, that they're plotting to raise prices. And that idea was at the heart of antitrust policy, that if corporations are allowed to get smaller or to engage in tactics that look like they're likely to cost people money, then you can pretty safely assume that people are going to be hurt by those actions. And the University of Chicago School, led by a guy named Aaron Director, argued systematically that corporate behavior in fact should be understood as innocent, that corporations were so busy trying to survive in this Darwinian marketplace that almost anything they were doing was simply aimed at their own survival and was the best and most reasonable course of policy and shouldn't be understood as predatory unless you could specifically prove that it was, that there was no reason to suspect corporations. You should give them the benefit of the doubt. And unless you could prove that something was harmful, you shouldn't seek to prevent it. Well, that's a very high standard. And in many cases, what it means is that even where reasonable people can look at a merger, say the merger right now of the two cell phone companies, T-Mobile and Sprint, who have been competing vigorously for years, in large part by offering lower prices to consumers, any reasonable person can look at that deal and say, hey, I know what's going to happen when those two companies get together. Prices are going to go up. Well, the Justice Department looks at that now and says, well, we can't actually prove that prices are going to go up, and therefore we need to let it happen. It's not good enough to you know, look at it and predict. And so that's an impossibly high standard, and it results from this conceit that markets are perfectly efficient and are delivering the best outcomes. And so what you get is, you know, you talked about how all the insulin prices are the same. Well, Director and his acolytes, people like Robert Bork, very famously, was one of his most important students. You know, they basically argued that it was implausible that companies would engage in cartels, in collusion with each other, and that you could pretty safely assume that any attempt at a cartel would fall apart. Well, in the 1990s, and I love this story, I tell it in the book, someone at the Justice Department had the clever idea of offering amnesty to the first company in a given cartel that confessed to what was happening. So if you got in the door first, you didn't get punished, but everyone else in the cartel would, and the cartel would be broken apart. This was really smart public policy, and it had the effect almost immediately of exponentially increasing the number of companies that were coming into the Justice Department to report that they were parts of cartels. And, you know, I talked to the guy who was the lead economist at the Justice Department in those years. And what he said to me was, we were stunned. We had this theory that said there basically are no cartels. And then we put it to practice. We tested it in the real world, and we discovered that the theory was nonsense. There were cartels everywhere. Companies were finding ways to coordinate pricing and to take advantage of consumers. And because the enforcers were in the grips of this economic theory that said markets are efficient, they weren't able to see the thing that was happening in plain sight and that was obvious to everyone else.
Oh, that's fascinating. It's such a wonderful part of the book. And what I was really drawn to was getting the background for people like Friedman, Keynes, Greenspan, Volcker. You had just so many rich quotes and direct experiences in the way you laid that all out. How did you even come across all of that material? I'm wondering what your research process was and where you found these amazing stories.
Yeah, so in part, by virtue of my position at the New York Times, I'm very lucky to have the opportunity to know many of these people personally. And so pretty much if a person in the book is still alive, the odds are very high that I have interviewed them, spoken to them, that I know them, that I'm describing someone who I've encountered and interacted with. But even for them, and certainly for the many people in the book who have already passed on, you know, one of the joys of this book for me was the opportunity to go back and learn about these lives and talk to people who knew them to the extent that that was still possible, to read their own works, their own writings, their own memoirs, to go into the archives, to read the letters that they wrote to each other, to read, you know, the papers that they prepared, the speeches they gave, the anecdotes they told at, you know, celebrations, to learn as much as I could about them. And so I really had the pleasure of, you know, spending time in archives and delving into this, you know, rich trove of historical material. While some of these people are not particularly well known to the general public, many of them were very important they were almost all very important in their own community. And so their lives are well documented and well recorded. Many of them had high regard for themselves and kept, you know, voluminous files of their own correspondence. And so there are rich archives of this material that I think really haven't been exploited for general history. So, you know, economists have a lot of interest in their own work and in their own field, although in general they're not overly curious about the history of the discipline. But I think, you know, there's sort of this wall where historians don't write about the economic aspects of history and economists don't write about the historical aspects of economics. And so I really found myself in this world of material that is fascinating and deeply relevant to the way our society has developed, but in my view, at least, really hasn't been written about enough.
I would agree with that. And the way you've brought it together, Benjamin, I get the sense, say, especially from chapter one, that back in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, there was really both an intellectual climate and very spirited public debates about really important topics, you know, conscription versus a volunteer military service, wealth inequality, how best to shape and balance taxes and monetary policy. There seemed like there were at least two sides to things, and they were publicly debated in a very spirited fashion. I don't really have that same sense today. It kind of all seems so settled, as if nobody in power is really questioning anything, as if there aren't two sides anymore. Is that have I overly romanticized from the period you've been writing about and maybe being unfair about characterizing the state of the debate today? It feels like almost debate-free in some important ways.
I think that's interesting. You know, I guess I'd say a couple of things about that. The first thing is that it feels to me, particularly with regard to economic policy and related areas, that we have had the Great Depression really sort of unmoored economic thinking and left people groping around for a new understanding of the world around them. And, you know, in the decades after the Great Depression, there was a lot of ferment and debate about how to understand what had happened. I think actually the same thing happened in the 1970s. There was a sense that the prevailing economic understanding of the world had proven inadequate or wrong, and that people were open to grappling with new approaches and new frameworks and new ideas. And I would like to think that the Great Recession of 2008 has opened a new period in which people once again can see that these prevailing economic ideas were flatly wrong, and that they are open to debate and to alternate frameworks and to new approaches to these issues. And I think that has happened to some extent. I don't think, you know, we've made as much progress as I'd like, but the presidency of Donald Trump is, among other things, a repudiation of the conventional wisdom about economic policy. Part of his success has been saying, you know, you guys are idiots. Now, it turns out he doesn't have better ideas, but I'm not sure that he's totally wrong in his critique of what had passed for the establishment. So I think that we are at least in a period of opportunity for new ideas to emerge. And I share your frustration that we haven't seen clear progress. But I guess the one thing I'd say about that is I think in writing a history, one of the things that is inevitable but probably a bit misleading is that I have probably tended to elevate the ideas that ultimately proved important to much greater prominence than would have been obvious at the time. So when I'm picking out the strains that became important and that emerged as dominant and saying, you know, back in the 40s, people were saying X. Well, back in the 40s, the people who were saying that thing weren't getting very much attention. And probably to the average person or even a fairly careful observer, it wouldn't have been obvious that, you know, things would unfold in the way that they did, and that these particular lines of critiques, which at the time were being essentially advanced by fringe characters who didn't really command the public spotlight, would eventually come to be seen as important. So I think that, you know, just by the nature of a book like this, it probably makes the debates in the past seem more center stage than they did at the time.
Sure, survivor bias, very real thing. And still, there, you know, you had a point in there where, I can't remember exactly where, but there was a time when 320, if I have the number right, you know, liberal intellectuals, you know, signed their names to something because they were very concerned and put it forward. And we look at who the heroes were back then. You had Einsteins, very prominent people who were intellectuals. And so it's it feels like the people were still openly grappling with things a bit. And so part of my frustration is, as you've rightly detected, is that centers on this idea that we underwent this thing called financialization, which has now hit a real crescendo. And we had bubble one in 2000, which was, I thought, a clear mark of a failure of Greenspan's policies of flooding the world with money, got a large bubble for it. And then Bernanke continued that. We got a housing bubble for our troubles then. And now today we have something maybe we could call the everything bubble, including $15 trillion of negative yielding debt, whatever that means, on and on. And so it feels to me that instead of learning the lessons of 2008, it was almost like a doubling down, like an intellectual dogma that said, we can't have gotten that wrong. We'll just do more of it this time. Do you have a sense that there's any concern in the economic sphere that maybe we're repeating mistakes that already proven unsuccessful twice?
Yeah, I guess I do want to push back a little bit because, listen, I think that, you know, there was an incredible homogenization of the economics profession. Really, I think, you know, part of it can be attributed to the collapse of communism really, you know, left the world with one dominant ideology. And in the manner of a monopolist, it became self-satisfied and it became very difficult to have discussions about the obvious flaws of capitalism. Capitalism became, you know, even more, capitalism prevailed in large part because it accommodated and compromised and understood its limitations and was administered, you know, not as an absolute truth, but as a part of the answer during the mid-century. And that's why it was so successful, because nations undertook seriously to look after the interest of their citizens and not just throw them on the mercy of the markets. But, you know, in an odd way, the collapse of communism allowed democracies to, you know, sort of embrace markets even more forcefully, and intellectual debate faded away. And I think, you know, there was a few decades there where there really was an absence of inquiry or curiosity or debate. But I guess where I would differ a little bit is I think that since the crisis, there really has been a revival of basic questions, a questioning of first principles, a search for alternatives. And you see people like, you know, Thomas Piketty or Emmanuel Saez advancing very different understandings of the mechanics of capitalism. You see, you know, people questioning, you know, the verities of the Washington Consensus, which was this recipe for economic development in third world countries. You see people like, you know, the economist Danny Roderick at Harvard really raising questions about the way we've approached third world development. And, you know, I could go on in this vein, but I think, you know, and furthermore, outside the realm of economics, you see people saying basically, listen, there are limits on what economics itself can teach us. We need to understand that economics exists in a context. There's a woman named professor named Marion Fourcade, who has been writing about, you know, the differences in the intellectual climate in Europe and the United States, and how Americans tend to, you know, American economists tend to assume that the market holds the answers, that the formulas themselves basically exist in the context of the societies in which they're written. So I do hear a lot of ferment. Maybe it's because I'm listening more carefully, but I do hear a lot of voices raising these questions, fomenting these debates, and I at least am hopeful that it will lead to positive change.
I'm hopeful as well, and I'm aware of those voices on the edge. I think I was really, my question was centered around the central banks, because so much power is vested there. And so when we look at the stated goals of, say, the Federal Reserve or any central bank out there, it's really the goal of any economist anywhere, right? They want to guide economic outcomes if they can to their most favorable conclusions. They talk about rising tides, lifting all boats. They measure things like advances in real wages, unemployment, rates of GDP growth. Yet in the past 30 years, if we go by empirical data, we've seen practically zero growth in real median household incomes. We've seen an explosive and widening wealth gap, predicted by many to be the logical consequence of what happens when you entertain quantitative easing and things like that. And a massive income gap, too. And of course, fairly large federal debt loads, unfunded or underfunded entitlement programs, all of that. But perhaps most challengingly at this point in time is the idea that these programs and policies of the U.S. Federal Reserve took a generation, the millennials, and really they got kind of tossed under the bus, right? You know, Ben Bernanke said specifically, we want to target house prices. We're going to buy mortgage-backed securities. We're going to lower the interest costs. Therefore, we're going to create a wealth effect by making house prices go up. Great policy for people who own houses, not a good policy for people who have yet to buy a house because, of course, buying an expensive house is tough. Now we're a decade into that, and houses are out of reach for people in, say, major metropolitan areas, San Francisco. So these are real social consequences to things, and yet I don't have any sense from any public statements by any Federal Reserve official that they feel even slightly responsible for that.
So I guess I want to say three things. The first is that the Fed is a great example of an institution that came under the dominance of economists. And, you know, I actually start my book with a story about Paul Volcker working as a young man at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and feeling that as an economist, he had no opportunities there. Yeah. And he wasn't wrong. At the time, there were no economists on the Fed board. The guy who ran the Fed, a guy named William McChesney Martin, has this amazing quote where he says, basically, you know, we keep the economists in the basement because, you know, they ask good questions. So that's why we keep them in the building at all. But we keep them in the basement because they don't give good answers. That's, you know, that's where the Fed was in the 1960s. They weren't at all sure that economists had much to add to the conversation. Martin was a financier, and that was the kind of person who tended to run the central bank. And as you say, during the course of the 1970s, the Fed comes under the dominion of economists, and those economists begin to focus on a much more narrow mission, which is basically controlling inflation. And Paul Volcker himself becomes the agent of that transformation. He's the guy who gives the Fed its clearest sense of new purpose, the idea that you just minimize inflation and everything else will work out okay. Now, as you say, that has some very clear distributional consequences. If you're just focusing on minimizing inflation, you end up doing it at the expense of unemployment. You end up doing it at the expense of wage growth. You're constantly cutting off economic revivals because you're worried things are going to get out of control. And the effect is to punish minorities, to punish the young, to punish the working class. And you see that really clearly, that the Fed over the last three decades really contributed to economic inequality through this single-minded focus on controlling inflation. And I think that's been hugely problematic, and I think it's a clear result of the dominance of economists and this tendency they have to, you know, reduce things to a simple formula and then rely on it. But the final thing I want to say is that I think you have seen a change at the Fed. I think there is an awareness of this history. I do hear Fed leaders talking about the distributional consequences of policy, placing a much greater emphasis on unemployment. Ben Bernanke, who was the chairman of the Fed during the financial crisis, you know, sort of started this shift. Janet Yellen, his successor, really placed a very heavy emphasis on unemployment and on the Fed's responsibility to improve the lives of ordinary people. And even under Jay Powell, her successor, the Fed has continued in that direction. And he's actually the first non-economist to lead the institution in modern times. And so we really are seeing, I think, a broadening of its sense of purpose and of the way that it understands the world. I guess the final thing I'd add, however, is that I think that there's far too much focus on the Fed, and that is actually a consequence of this economist's hour as well. Milton Friedman, who we haven't talked much about yet, but who is really the central character in my book, was enormously successful, perhaps his greatest triumph against the Keynesians. The Keynesians, the disciples of John Maynard Keynes, were the people who came out of the Great Depression convinced that government needed to play a larger role in the economy, and specifically that government should spend money during downturns, that fiscal policy was the great answer to economic cataclysm, and that when things got bad, the government should throw money at the problem. And Friedman was enormously successful in convincing economists and then policymakers that fiscal policy was essentially impotent, and that monetary policy was everything, and that you should just focus on regulating the supply of money, and that was the best government could do. Anything more than that would be terribly damaging. And that minimal government, that doing the least was also the most you could do. That has really become rather pervasive as a mentality, this understanding that the Fed holds the answer to our problems and that the Fed is in charge and that we need to rely on the Fed to answer for these problems. And I think it's fundamentally wrong. Fiscal policy is tremendously underrated and underutilized. And if there is a villain in this story of the loss of a generation, which I fear is very much what we're seeing, that villain is Congress and not the Fed. It is the failure of our fiscal authorities to invest in this economy, to ensure that we are spending enough money and spending it on education and infrastructure and research, that is causing our economy to sputter. The Fed, I think, has power, clearly, and there is no doubt a degree to which it hasn't used that power effectively. But these discussions about the Fed, this unrelenting focus on the Fed, is itself a product of this economist's view of the world that I think is far too narrow and in important respects misleading.
Well, I love this battle between Friedman and Keynes, as if they were literally in a tug of war. This idea that it's monetarism that's what you need to focus on and control, and that had its day in the sun. It looks like Keynes is coming back to have his day in the sun. And all of this, of course, leads us to where we are. And there are huge political consequences to this. I think you rightly noted that it was against the backdrop that we've been talking about that Trump was elected, at least in part, by promising to be different to the working classes, right? He was at least saying something that working people could say, oh, I hear myself in that story. That's new, because it had been missing for a little while. And now we have in this election cycle actually a fairly interesting drumbeat for this idea of modern monetary theory, or MMT, which is the idea of the government spending money, and that if it does so, there's very few consequences to be had, because of course it can print its own money when you strip away a few layers. So that idea has gained a lot of traction, and at least in part, that's because under the former guise of financialization and how the Fed had conducted itself, it was very clear that capital won, workers lost. This was a pretty clear thing. Well, maybe you don't agree with that, but that's how I'm seeing it, you know, because the Federal Reserve would lower rates, and you would see capital start to flood into the markets, and it showed up. And as long as, you know, stocks were rising and corporations were doing well, Fed didn't care. But as soon as wages started to rise, as soon as labor started to share, they would say, ah, that's too far. That's where inflation comes in. We're going to target that. And then would club that back down again, of course, by raising rates. So in that long sweep of things over time, the scales tilted. Labor ended up with less and less. That shows up in the median household wage data and other things like that. And capital sort of won. MMT seems to be a pushback against that, at least in part. Is that fair? And do you think is Keynes coming back now?
So I think capital won, workers lost is a perfectly good summary of the modern era. But again, I just want to broaden the lens and say, while the Fed played a role in that, so did government policies that mm-hmm. disempowered unions, So did the failure of the government to substitute itself for the union movement and, for example, to make sure that minimum wage laws or workplace safety laws kept pace with the economy. So did, you know, the emphasis on globalization and free trade with developing nations. So did the failure to invest in education or research or infrastructure. The economy failed workers in many ways. The Fed is one of them, but I'm not even convinced it's the most important. I think that, you know, we really want to take a broad view of all of the ways in which public policy has favored capital at the expense of labor, because it's a long list, and the solution surely lies in addressing those issues across that broad waterfront. If you just focus on monetary policy, you're not going to get the changes that you need, because you're not going to have addressed the many other ways that the system has been tilted against workers. The only other thing I'd add is, you know, I think MMT is a great example of, you know, the efflorescence of new ideas in the wake of the crisis. And it is one of those new approaches to economics that has gained a lot of traction in public debate and is being talked about and considered. And, you know, I think that sort of that process is really healthy, and it gives people an opportunity to examine those ideas and think about them and decide which ones ought to move forward. I wish I shared your confidence that Keynes is ascendant again. I think that there certainly are people who subscribe to his ideas, some of which have proved more durable than others. In the United States in particular, one great Keynesian legacy is the substitution. It's sort of a bastard version of Keynes, but the idea that tax cuts are the best form of economic stimulus is sort of the American version of Keynes, and it remains in good favor. Other Keynesian ideas have been less successful over time, and maybe we will see them coming back. I think that probably would be a good thing on the whole.
Well, tax cuts, of course, depending on where they're targeted, the most recent corporate tax cuts, tracking them, seems to have resulted in share buybacks, which are of dubious or arguable benefit to the broad society in terms of what we're talking about here. So it would be interesting to see where to have a spirited tax debate again that would talk about maybe where that could really come, because tax cuts really do come at the expense of spending.
That's right. And that's really the most important. That's why I refer to it as a bastard Keynesian approach. I mean, and this has been obvious. The turn toward tax cuts begins in the 1960s under John Kennedy. And at that time, his liberal advisors are very divided on it. Some see it as, you know, the only plausible approach to fiscal stimulus, because you can't convince conservatives to increase government spending. But others warn quite presciently that if you start down that road, what you're going to do is restrict government spending over time. And I think that has proved to be right. The United States has failed to develop the sort of fiscal capacity that other Western democracies have to provide social services and investment in the economy, because of this reliance on tax cuts, and it's really been constraining and problematic. So even if you're targeting, I mean, you're clearly right that the recent tax cuts are a disaster on multiple levels, and one of those levels is that they gave all the money to the wealthy. But even beyond that, I have real misgivings about tax cuts for the middle class, too, because I think that, you know, the balance is out of whack. We're not in a position to make the societal investments that we need to make.
Well, in Chapter 4, which is Representation Without Taxation, you start that with a quote from one of my all-time favorites, John Kenneth Galbraith, who said, "What is called sound economics is very often what mirrors the needs of the respectably affluent," end quote. I just love the way he puts things. A very pithy, quotable guy. This idea, though, that the title of the book, The Economist's Hour, suggests that they've had their hour. Where do you see this the ascendancy of this profession of economics? I mean, has it done what it's going to do at this point in time? Has it hit its peak, or does it continue from here?
Well, I think it's in crisis for sure, right? I mean, you've seen in the United States, certainly, you've seen the election of a man who holds economics and economists in lower regard than any other modern American president. Right. You've seen, you know, His vice president, Mike Pence, said even before taking office, you know, markets have had their day. They didn't deliver the results we wanted. You know, we're going to try a new approach. It's inconceivable to imagine a Republican elected official saying that even a decade ago. So it's clear that economists are at least temporarily out of favor in this White House, but not just here. You've had British officials saying, you know, during the Brexit process, you know, we don't need any advice from economists. You know, those guys are idiots. We're done listening to them. You've seen a real turn away from the verities of economics about free trade, about balanced budgets, about, this is true on the liberal side as well. You know, this rejection of, you know, for years, economists of all stripes basically warned against minimum wage laws. Well, you know, a lot of people have decided that they were wrong, I think with considerable justification. And so we're seeing, you know, states and local governments increasing minimum wages in defiance of what was conventional wisdom among economists until very recently. You're seeing renewed fervor around antitrust, both on the left and on the right. So I think, you know, a lot of areas of public policy, there's a new willingness to question economic laws, economic principles. And it will be interesting to see whether economics evolves in ways that maintain its utility. I think it is fundamentally a useful way of thinking about the world. It imposes a discipline on thought that I find useful. It forces an articulation of costs and benefits. It makes you think about what you know and what you don't know. It's a useful set of tools. I think that it was mistaken for a religion, and that was hugely unfortunate. But I think it would be a mistake to throw it out altogether. And the challenge now is whether we can get to a better place. I said about Trump once already, but I think he's asking a lot of good questions about the way things are. I think his answers are, for the most part, terribly unfortunate. And so the question is whether we can find a politics that offers better answers.
I'll tell you, one of the more instrumental books in shaping my understanding of economics was called The Origin of Wealth by Eric Beinhacker. And he tells this fascinating story about this meeting at the Santa Fe Institute. They bring in, you know, Nobel Prize winning chemists, physicists, economists, all that. And they're all sitting around the table. And the economists are laying out, you know, their formulas. They've got all these fancy formulas. They're talking about equilibrium and all that stuff. And the physicists and chemists all just sit back in shock, because they're using closed form equations that were derived by Walras back in the 1700s, before the second law of thermodynamics had come about. And so they were still seeking an equilibrium in an open system that's an impossibility. And so they were just shocked that economists had a fairly dogmatic religious approach to how they were viewing the world. And this brings me to my actual largest critique of the economics profession, and this is my work in the world. I think they've confused correlation with causation. The true driver of economic growth is actually expansion and use of energy. I'm a biologist by training underneath all this. So, I mean, that's it, period, full stop. That energy, fossil fuels, 400 million years of ancient sunlight that's being unlocked in a brief explosion of about 200 years. Everything's a derivative of that. So instead of even, you know, noting that or working into their models or even being aware of it at all, as far as I can tell, except for the biophysical economists, the economists have fashioned an entire dogma around this idea that infinite exponential growth is not only possible on a finite planet, but it's desirable, right? That's the goal. The undesirable consequences of that are now becoming clear, right? We've got species loss, we've got climate change, we've got strip-mined ocean, Midwest soils. Growth cannot continue forever. That's a hypothesis. And I've not read a single line in a single paper from a single central bank that has even bothered to explore that idea. It's like off limits. If it's a topic, then they've studiously ignored it or kept it buried. Did you run across any sense of that maybe collision between our economic approaches and desire for growth and what's happening in the natural world? Did that come up?
So I think that, in the economics profession generally, so first off, I mean, I really agree that, you know, sort of a core fundamental problem with economics is that it's the lone claimant to be a science that doesn't seem to have noticed that the world tends toward entropy. And, you know, you just have to wonder about how a discipline has arrived at a set of principles based on the notion that there is an equilibrium and that the world will return to it naturally. But, you know, on the broader question, I think that central banks may be the wrong place to look for that type of work because by their nature, they tend to be focused on the short term. And I accept, I think you're right that that's probably not sufficient and that they need to incorporate, you know, the long term is comprised of a whole bunch of short terms and they need to start thinking about what that means. But I do see economists wrestling with natural resource constraints, and they've actually been doing it for a long time. And there's a whole field, you know, to me, one of the most interesting chapters in this book is about cost-benefit analysis, the rise of the idea that economics should be used to assess public policy by quantifying the costs of a policy and quantifying the benefits of a policy and moving ahead with the policies that on balance are beneficial. And this idea is really one of the most powerful ways in which economics has transformed policymaking. It has become part of a vast range of government functions, particularly in the regulatory space. And that work, at least one of its sort of points of origin, is in a concern about finite natural resources. There was a government commission sponsored by the Ford Foundation in the 1950s that during one of these periods of occasional concern that fossil fuels were about to run out, that went and looked at the availability of natural resources around the world. And in addition to offering terribly inaccurate estimates of how much stuff was left, arrived at the more useful conclusion that that question ought to be part of public policymaking and that it ought to guide the government's approach to various kinds of decisions. And that was one of the forerunners of the cost-benefit analysis of public policies. And I think you've seen that insight integrated into the work of a long line of economists who have sought to think about what it means that we live in a world with finite resources. So I think that you are right that strain of thinking has not had any evident influence on central banking, and it needs to, and it should, but it does exist as a line of work.
Well, and outside of central banking, it's clearly something that ought to be considered as a longer range part of public policy. One of the things that I get to do a lot is interact with people who are very thoughtful about the direction of things. These are people at NASA, to millennials, whomever. And one of the critiques out there is, where's the sense of direction? Where are we going? I think we had a sense of that in the 50s, in the 60s even, as turbulent as they were. There was a sense of where we're going. But if all of a sudden you see that we can't have economic growth forever, the question of where we're going becomes lost under a sea of, well, the F-150 sales were pretty good this last quarter, so we're doing good. So what I really admire about your book is the way in which it traces these different arcs out and all these different threads that get us to where we are. And as you look back at all these different pieces that you pulled in, where do you see things going forward, as if you just not as Yogi Berra said, I don't want you to make predictions about the future because those are difficult. But if you just extrapolate the trends, where are we headed?
So, you know, one reason I like writing about history is because it's easier to understand what has happened than to predict what's going to happen. I feel like we're at a real fork in the road, and there is a very plausible path ahead of us in which our ability to grapple with our problems continues to deteriorate. I think we haven't talked much about inequality today, but I think one of the most important consequences of the embrace of economic policies has been the huge rise in economic inequality in this country. And one of the debilitating consequences of inequality, which I think is terribly underappreciated, is that it makes it very difficult to have a functional democracy. It really limits the shared space in which people can get together and agree on policies that serve all of their interests, because their interests have become so diverse. So I think that inequality itself threatens our ability to constructively confront our societal problems and challenges. And I worry immensely about that. And I think economics is very much to blame for us having reached that pass, that state in our affairs. So that's the bleak version, is that We're in a kind of crisis, not just a kind of crisis. I think we're in crisis. We're in crisis in terms of our ability to confront problems, in terms of our ability to make good choices, to build public consensus around positive public policy. And it's not clear how we escape from it. The more positive version is that I do think many people are aware that we are confronting this problem. I do sense a renewed urgency among at least some political leaders to confront these issues. I think it comes not just from one side of the political spectrum, which is probably necessary for us to move forward. I think, you know, finding common ground remains very difficult, but step one is surely for us to agree about the nature of the problem, and I hear more and more of that. And so I'm optimistic that, you know, we will find, you know, a way to begin to address some of these problems. But, you know, I don't want to suggest that I'm wholly optimistic. I think, you know, these are big issues, and we've caused ourselves a lot of problems by the way that we've dealt with public policy over the last half century. And if we don't start doing things differently and soon, it's hard to see how this all ends well.
Indeed, one of the more fascinating parts of your book for me was the way you track the rise of corporations and corporate power. And I just had the sense of the social obligation and the role of corporations. It just really shifted over time. You know, that whole brilliant story about AT&T developing and patenting the transistor and then saying, hey, we need to share this, with a little encouragement from the government. But, you know, they didn't fight that tooth and nail. They had a sense of this is an important development and we're all going to share in this, which may be missing today. And it reminds me of that quote from Plutarch way back when, who said that the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics is a gap between the rich and the poor. And so that widening wealth gap feels like one of the urgent sort of things we need to think about and tackle here. But it is encouraging that at least it's becoming part of the conversation now. And that's why I truly think that your book is really important for people to read. I'm going to give it a double thumbs up. Everybody who's listening, I would highly encourage this because it gives just such great background and gives you a sense of how we got here. And that arc is really important to understand. We didn't just arrive here accidentally, as you sometimes will maybe be forgiven for believing happened if you just read the news and watch it on TV. Sometimes it presents things as if they just occurred. They didn't. There's a long story behind how we got here, and it's an absolutely fascinating one. So, Benjamin, thank you for writing that book. Congratulations. It's really fantastic.
Hey, thank you. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
And thank you so much for your time today. We've been talking with Benjamin Applebaum. He wrote The Economist's Hour. Please find it and read it. And we'll continue this conversation at our website around that. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you next time.